Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Takeout ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
It's 3 o'clock somewhere. Time for a My Mochi ice cream snack. My Mochi ice cream is cool, creamy scoops of premium ice cream wrapped in sweet, pillowy dough. And get this, all of My Mochi's fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, double chocolate, and cookies and cream, are only around 80 calories per piece. Talk about a guilt-free, indulgent experience. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned, gluten-free mochis that are great for grab-and-go. So feel good while curbing your afternoon cravings or the midnight munchies. Yeah, you know who you are, with the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream. Find My Mochi ice cream at Target or visit MyMochi.com to locate a grocery store near you.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
But who's counting, right?
His name is Major.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen,
please welcome Major Garrett
from the nation's capital.
Major, fantastic.
It's The Takeout.
This is a major achievement.
With CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent.
Major Garrett.
Yes, CBS. Yes, hi.
Major Garrett.
Major, that's nonsense, and you should know better.
Is Major out of the doghouse?
The answer is yes.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. Those of you who love this show, and there are many across the country and the world for that matter, know I care about one issue right now more than any other. What happened in the 2020 presidential election, and more importantly, what did not happen in the 2020 election? And how confusion and bitterness about that set of facts continues to haunt our politics and jeopardize the future of this great, grand, and glorious constitutional republic, an experiment handed down to us by the founding fathers. So we're going to continue that conversation today. My special guest is Ken Block. He has a book, and I want to read you the full title and subtitle. It's one of the longest subtitles I've ever encountered in American publishing history. The title, one word, Disproven. The subtitle, listen carefully, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the Data that Shows Why He Lost, and How We Can Improve Our Elections. Ken Block, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Unbiased. You know that is in itself a volatile word in our current political atmosphere, though it ought not to be.
Undoubtedly.
Tell my audience why you can so confidently assert that your perspective on this central question is unbiased. Yeah.
So I'm a data analyst. I'm a relational database expert. I came into this entire agreement with the Trump campaign, which fell out of the sky. Literally.
Just to be clear, you worked for the Trump campaign after the election.
Yeah, I got the phone call the day, 2 days after the election, asking me to look for voter fraud for the Trump campaign. The lawyer who reached out to me was a guy named Alex Cannon. And as we negotiated sort of the rules of engagement for what I would do and how I would do it, I wanted to make very clear that I wasn't promising a specific result. That in a decade of looking at voter data across the country, I'd never encountered anything close to what I knew the Trump campaign needed me to find. And I wanted to make sure he understood I wasn't promising a result and that I wouldn't accept any special requests for a specific finding. I was supposed to deliver findings that could inform lawsuits and that would stand up in court. That's the biggest phrase, stand up in court. And Alex, to his great credit, told me that he wanted the kind of look that I was going to do. he didn't want a custom order set of results because his professional reputation, I'm surmising, was going to be on the line.
As well as yours.
As well as mine. And he understood. He said that was the approach that he wanted. And with that, off I went. And probably, without doubt, the craziest 35 days of my life.
Mm-hmm. And when you began this work, did you have a hunch one way or the other?
Well, I told him I didn't expect that we would be able to deliver the results he was looking for. Just based
meaning
on
sufficient to
sufficient
overturn
to overturn
a
to overturn.
And tell
election.
My audience why, based on that 10 years of experience you refer to, you didn't expect to find either mismanagement or fraud or something legally actionable that could overturn the result of 10,000, 20,000 votes.
Yeah. So I've looked in depth at duplicate votes and deceased voters in about 42 states across the country over the years. And I found the largest body of duplicate vote fraud that I found was attached to the 2016 election, where I found about 8,500 votes that I could confirm were individuals who took two bites at the apple, but that was across 35 different states.
Again, not sufficient in magnitude to alter the results in any way.
Right, right. And the whole narrative itself, that when people talk about voter fraud, especially when conservatives talk about voter fraud, it's attached to, and Democrats do it all the time. And what I found looking at voter fraud in the 2016 election was that Republicans committed the duplicate vote crime just as often as Democrats did. There wasn't a partisan bias to the whole thing.
And that's a really important point, Ken. I'm glad you raised that, because there is this assumption that if there's X number of votes that someone questions, all of them went in one direction.
Right.
And that would therefore catapult, in this case, former President Trump back into office. Your experience, the real live evidence is no, those are probably, if they are questionable votes, which is a huge legal hurdle in the first place, but even if they are, they're probably going to cut in ways that are relatively similar to the way all the other votes cut.
Sure, but what you're touching on right now needs further explanation.
Please, please.
Because let's imagine, now I did not find this, I'm creating an imaginary scenario.
Okay, did not find this,
I did
imaginary
not find
scenario.
It's actually, and it has to be, I have to be very careful to be very clear and when I talk about
please.
This, because I can be taken out of context very readily. So let's imagine that I found 15,000 fraudulent votes cast in Georgia in 2020, and the margin of victory is call it 12,000.
12,000,
so let's imagine
right.
I found 15,000.
Let's imagine.
It's imaginary. Even had I found it, the Trump campaign could never prove the harm necessary to prove in court that those fraudulent votes worked against the campaign. And so that's a remarkable thing that many people lose track of. It's one thing to find the votes. It's quite another thing to show the harm and that those votes all went against Trump. You can't possibly do that, because when we vote in this country...
Thank you so much.
Oh, perfect. Thank
Ken's,
you. I have no idea how I'm
gonna,
I have no idea how I'm going to do this.
In between breaks. During the breaks, so, you're going to do it, Ken. Any day now is our restaurant, by the way.
I actually brought a lobster bit. I bought two. So if you were going to eat, you know, we could maybe set ourselves up. But
we'll get to the Rhode Island angle in a second.
So you can't show the harm, because we vote anonymously when we vote. You can't trace the votes back to figure. So if I found 15,000 votes cast by registered voters for some reason, let's say they were all deceased votes, you still don't know how those votes were cast. You can't show the harm. I can't imagine a legal scenario where a judge would overturn or either cancel the election or overturn it without being able to fundamentally prove that those votes went against the Trump campaign. It can't be done. So all of these court cases, I think, would have failed even had all the fraud been found.
We'll get to some of the specifics in a minute, but when you reported back the evidence you found, did you encounter angry reactions from Alex or anyone in the Trump campaign?
No, so Alex was terrific to work with, because not only did he understand the framing in which I was willing to do the work, he told me that he would keep me shielded from all the political pressures that were coming down on him from above. So the White House didn't know that my company specifically was doing the work. So then I couldn't have the political pressures brought upon me, which made my work far easier to do because I wasn't I didn't need to fend off pressure from anywhere else. Alex was taking care of that, and Alex accepted my findings. The other lawyers that he worked with accepted my findings. He told the January 6th committee that he took my findings to Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff at the time. Mark Meadows' response to Alex, as he stated to the January 6th committee, and this made the televised hearings,
yes.
Mark Meadows' response to hearing that not only could the campaign not find fraud, but all of the claims that were brought to the campaign's attention were also disproven. And Meadows' response to that was, that means there's no there, when he's talking about the claims of voter fraud. And then at the end of 2023, there were news reports that Meadows, in his communications with Jack Smith's investigators, told them that he brought the findings of no fraud into the Oval Office.
Where they did encounter hostility from the former president.
You would assume that they did, yes.
Based on the rhetoric that followed. Our guest is Ken Block. The book, again, Disproven, with the longest subtitle in the history of American publishing, but it's an important one. I will read it again. My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the Data That Show Why He Lost, and How We Can Improve Our Election. Segment 2 of The Takeout, coming your way in just one second.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move, or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. Sound the gifting panic alarm. We've all been there. You need to find the perfect gift. You have absolutely zero ideas and you don't know where to start. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. Just answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like, and Gift Mode gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Imagine pages of artisan espresso mugs for the coffee connoisseur in your life, or for the pickleballer, customized paddle covers in every shade imaginable. Etsy's got you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Welcome back to The Takeout. As I mentioned in the first segment, any day now is our restaurant. And when I say host restaurant, just for clarification, they don't buy our food. We pay for our food. They just make room for us because we kind of roll slightly large and restaurants need to accommodate their customers and we're happy when they accommodate us. Any day now, thanks so much for hosting. Ken Block is our guest. Disproven is the book. I won't read the subtitle again, but we'll get back to that in a second. I want to know, Ken, what has the reaction been to your book? Because you know and I know that there's a wide swath of Americans who don't need to read this book, who don't believe the 2020 election was stolen, but you and I both want to reach the people who believe it was. Yeah. We don't want to lecture them. I don't want to call them names. I want to bring them back into the American conversation in a way that they feel comfortable and we can agree on some basic,
right,
discoverable, verifiable facts. You know the part of America I'm talking about.
I do.
What's the reaction been?
So, muted.
Okay.
Is the best way that I could frame it so far. It's actually been very frustrating as we put together the book tour and we're reaching out to media across the spectrum. There's really been crickets from conservative media about covering anything to do with my story going back a year ago when the Washington Post broke the story that I was served a subpoena by Jack Smith.
Right.
So the only coverage I've had in conservative media in over a year was a Washington Examiner story about summertime last year, just mentioning the fact that I'd received a subpoena. And then I gave an hour-long interview to the Epoch Times about 4 weeks ago. And the framing of the reason that they reached out to me was the Homeland Group, I think, and Rasmussen had produced a poll about massive mail ballot fraud. And the poll itself was wholly just done completely wrong, and it holds no water at all. And so we started talking about that, and I quickly put to bed the whole poll because no foundation in science, no foundation in fact. And then we just talked about the book a little bit, and the only quotes that I gave him that made the story, but they were important quotes, I said, I was hired by the Trump campaign to find evidence of fraud, to change an election result, and most importantly, would stand up in court. And it utterly wasn't there. We were not able to find anything that met those criteria. And that's just a plain, cold fact. And he printed that verbatim as I gave it to him. And for conservatives to hopefully have read that and absorbed it, I think is the important thing. I took as even a tone as I could as I wrote this book.
You did.
This is not about bashing anybody, and it's not about throwing roses at anybody, right? Nope. This is about facts, facts, facts. And I can back these facts up with anybody who wants to come at me and challenge what I did, what my agenda might have been. Mm-hmm. You know, there was none. This was about doing the job that the campaign needed me to do so that if I had found fraud sufficient to change an election result, I could have gone to court, made it stand up, and given the campaign the chance to make their case and be successful. And the challenge was there just wasn't the fraud available to get to that point.
Mm-hmm. And I hope you take this as a compliment. The book is a bit dry, meaning it's not passionate in the sense of you're trying to use loaded language
correct
to make your point.
Correct.
You're not trying to lead the witness, yep, as it were. And I find that a very great strength of the book. Talk to me about things that you talk about in the book that people who have questions about the 2020 election still cling to, like double counting, double voting, or deaths, people who are on the rolls, dead people voting.
Yeah, let's talk about deceased voters, because that's one of the, I'm going to use the word easier, but it's simply because it lacks the complexity of duplicate votes where you have to deal with voter registrations from multiple different states. So for the deceased voters, the campaign handed me every mail ballot record cast in the swing states. And we all know the states by heart.
Yes.
Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yep.
There were 21 million mail ballot votes that I think that's a number that I looked at. It could have been registrations, mail ballot. I'm not sure which one it was. But we looked at 21 million records, and we looked at all of them to determine if they were alive or dead. And when we applied whether they were alive or dead to the actual ballots cast, we found singleton numbers of deceased votes that were cast. Less than 10 in virtually every single swing state. Now, even if we found 100, it's still nowhere close to what it needed to be.
Right.
And what's interesting, and I think it's worth pointing out, I really know what I'm doing when it comes to this particular evaluation. I had taken a look at Pennsylvania's voter registration, the full voter rolls, in September of 2020. And I found a couple of registrants who had died in 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, but they had been registered to vote in September of 2020. And I looked at those and I said, you watch. These are incipient voter fraud that's coming, right? You're going to watch this. And it happened. And what's interesting is that finding was entered into as evidence in a court case that was being run in October of that year. So it's on the record. It's right there. Election officials knew about these potentially fraudulent votes and deceased registrants, did nothing to stop it. The votes were cast. The votes were counted. And then after the election, the voter was removed from the rolls as being deceased, and the people responsible for casting those ballots were arrested and convicted. So it's kind of remarkable that it happened, and it happened easily, right? Mm-hmm. So, but that doesn't mean it's happening everywhere, because there are substantial penalties attached to doing it. And for everyone out there who's thinking, well, if it was so easy to do, I'm going to do it, I can catch you.
Yep, you can't be caught.
Yeah.
And it's a prosecutable crime.
5 years in jail and $10,000 fine at the top end.
Talk to me about something else that is becoming topical and will probably become more topical. Non-citizen voting.
Yeah.
Please.
So, several times I've been asked about non-citizen voting over the years. In fact, Vice President Pence's office had me in to the old executive office's building for a day, and I spoke to Pence's staff about the issue. And the challenge for everybody in talking about whether non-citizens are voting or not is there is no database anywhere that you can look at that gives you a list of everybody who is either a citizen or is not a citizen. In fact, the only database that I'm aware of at all cannot be used for this purpose, and that's the Department of Homeland Security's database, which is, by federal law, sealed off from any kind of access
for
like we're talking about. So with that huge caveat in mind, and I told Alex Cannon repeatedly as we were talking about, and specifically Arizona non-citizen voting, and I said the closest we can get is using credit bureau information, where credit bureaus have access to Social Security numbers and that sort of thing, and we can try to identify registered voters who don't have Social Security numbers at the credit bureaus or don't even exist in the credit bureaus as maybe some indicator, but it's not, you can't take that to the bank because many students don't show up in the credit bureaus. People who don't own homes and don't have cell phones, there's a thousand reasons why the credit bureaus don't know somebody. And I said, and the worst problem really is young people who don't show up. And just because they don't show up doesn't mean they're not a citizen. In fact, they very likely are. I was given a file of, I think, 1,500 or 2,500 potential non-citizen votes that were cast in Arizona. And the names weren't what you would think. There were as many McGregors as there were Rodriguezes, right? I mean, it was really, I don't know who came up with the list. It was kind of an extraordinary list. And we ran it, even with all the caveats. And what came back was most of the, about 1,000 of the records we found in the credit bureaus, and everything looked good. For everybody else, the majority of the ones we couldn't find were young.
Young.
And I said, that's game over right there. You can't go to court with something as muddled as the results that we're seeing here. You can't say with any certainty that any of the people that didn't get a hit are not citizens.
Right.
And it took that to put the thing to bed, and we did. It's a very unsatisfying answer. Wouldn't it be great to be able to say with some certainty it's happening or it's not happening? And in that particular case, I don't think anybody can. And the claims that it's happening in massive scale can't be proven or disproven.
That is the voice of Ken Block. Segment 3 of The Takeout coming your way in just 1 second. Welcome back to The Takeout, our host restaurant any day now. I think about that in this context. Get over the 2020 election any day now, please. I'm begging you. Ken Block is our special guest. The book Disproven, subtitle, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the data that shows why he lost and how we can improve our elections.
By the way, I would gladly take any suggestions on how I could possibly shorten that up. But
No need to. I want to read it in full. Back to non-citizens. It is against federal law to vote as a non-citizen. And if you vote in person, you have to show some verification of your registration status. And most people who are non-citizens would be intimidated by that. They wouldn't go in because they could be subject to discovery, which is one of the reasons that the data and the surveys suggest that this is not nearly the problem it is described to be.
Yeah. If somebody is here in violation of the law, are they going to stick their neck out and expose themselves to trouble when they'd need or want to be here because they're working or whatever the situation is? To really get involved in our electoral process seems like an unnecessary risk, and I think people by and large are risk averse.
Precisely.
So it's hard to imagine that it's happening at scale. I think there's other more plausible ways that someone could take advantage of weaknesses in our electoral system other than this one. Now, again, not that it's happening. I'm just saying, if I was going to script something for somebody, there's other ways that you would do it.
Another assertion, mail-in balloting is a pathway. The former president suggests it's a highway to voter fraud. Is it?
It can be. I don't believe that it is, because to cast, let's say, in the case of Georgia, 12,000 fraudulent illegal mail ballots is difficult. And I want to describe the process, because the process of casting a mail ballot is pretty complicated, and you would need an army of people doing it. So the way it would work, or the way it works, when you cast a vote by mail, maybe a lot of people haven't, you have to fill in a form requesting a mail ballot.
Right.
You send it in. Election workers confirm that you are who you have a valid record, and that everything works, matches in terms of your date of birth, your address, and everything else. Only if all that works, they will then mail you an actual ballot, right? And many people don't understand it's a two-step process. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the fraud claims that came to me working for the Trump campaign were by people who didn't even understand how the mail ballot process worked.
Right.
So the ballot, actual ballot, is mailed out. You have to cast your vote on the ballot. You have to fill out an inner envelope with, and this varies by state by state by state. It gets very complicated at this point. Some states require you to put your date of birth, your address, and other things. Some states require you to provide additional documentation
right.
along with it. The unevenness in how we handle things like this, as a computer guy, drives me crazy. It's not right that we can't do it all the same way in every state, and I think we should. Back part of the book.
Right.
And once it's all filled out, the outer envelope, the inner envelope is sealed. You put it in the outer envelope, which is for mailing. You send it in. Again, election workers are going to confirm, match your signature potentially, which is a terrible way to confirm identity. And only then does the vote count. So you can see with all these steps and the checks that are in the middle, it's certainly possible. But to do thousands this way, I think, would be extraordinarily difficult.
Some in my audience would be saying, wait a minute, some states, don't they send them to everyone?
There are some states that do their elections wholly on mail ballot. I believe Oregon is doing it, right?
Yep.
I think
Colorado
right?
It.
Right.
Yep. So Washington State, I believe,
now,
also.
As a candidate?
You were once a candidate,
I was a candidate.
That's the Rhode Island reference and the lobster bib thing, yes.
Yeah. So I ran for governor in Rhode Island twice. And part of the campaign is you architect your final message, right? So the grand finale to a year and a half of campaigning is what you're going to tell your voters in the really ideally the last week of the election, because so many people don't pay attention up until that point in time. With early voting, in some cases, the early voting window can be multiple weeks. Mm-hmm. You have a challenge and a problem with a campaign, because if you bring out your final message too early, a lot of voters that you need to reach aren't even going to receive that message,
right?
And you have a limited budget. Most people have a limited budget in terms of media and everything else. So it's a hard thing. And I know we shouldn't craft our election regulations keeping candidates in mind.
Right.
But, you know, it can be a challenge. And in a presidential election with the different windows all over the country, I can't even imagine the headache involved in trying to figure out your messaging strategy with the windows all over the place. So I'm a big fan of standardization. I think that we need more federal guidance on how elections should be how they should work, and that all the states have to adhere to common sense ones. And my suggestions that I come up with are nonpartisan. I'm not trying to convey any kind of advantage to one partisan or another. Mm-hmm. These are just things I think we need to do to get better elections.
Talk to me about another thing that often crops up in this conversation, with lots of confusion around it, ballot harvesting.
Yeah, I hate it. So what ballot harvesting is, so first of all, it's legal in about 25 states. So
right.
When anybody talks about ballot harvesting and then either infers or outright says it's illegal, well, it's not. I think it should be, okay? And here's why. Because, and again, I'm going to fall back to my Rhode Island experience. So Rhode Island has very strict laws that says candidates and their campaign staff and their volunteers on election day can't stand within 100 feet of the entrance of a polling place. Makes sense.
Right.
Voters shouldn't have to run a gauntlet
of electioneering
to get in there. In Rhode Island, because ballot harvesting is legal and candidates themselves can actually harvest the ballots, a candidate or that candidate's staff or volunteers can literally look over the shoulder of a voter at their kitchen table while they cast their vote. And the dissonance for me is, how can you care so much about the in-person voting and the
privacy
and the privacy there and not have it there? But
right.
the worst problem with ballot harvesting is should our elections be determined by whichever campaign apparatus can collect the most votes? Mm-hmm. I am a guy who thinks that you win your votes on the merits, which I know is kind of quaint and probably why I lost. And it's a, I don't think that we should, our elections should be determined by aggressive ballot collection and returning. I think that voters in most scenarios can cast their ballots. In the scenarios where they can't, nursing homes and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think caregivers, specifically with a job, should be empowered to collect the ballots on the behalf of the people they care for. And if you're being home cared for, it can be a close family member.
Right.
So we don't want to make it hard.
You would not
for
classify that as harvesting.
No, right, right. I mean, well, some people do.
Right.
But I think that you
but
need
But that would
to,
be in a different category, that,
yeah,
functionally and legally.
Right.
It so ought to be.
We want to empower people right. to vote. But I think we want to stop the practice of aggressively collecting and turning in ballots.
How about drop boxes? Do you find anything baseline fraudulent about drop boxes?
I think that they do represent a bit of a security problem where, you know, you have an unmonitored drop box. Who knows how ballots get in there? I think if you have video surveillance of the boxes, I think that you can solve
which
a lot of
those. Which most jurisdictions
do. I think you can solve a lot of those problems.
Vast majority of jurisdictions do have video.
I mean, you know, in 2020, I voted by mail and I got a mail ballot and I dropped it in the drop box.
And let me push back a little bit on that because I think of a drop box as more secure than
the
postal
mail.
Delivery because fewer people touch it.
It's more certain.
The Dropbox is a Dropbox. It's a central place that has video surveillance, and it is the one and only place. And they're picked from there, and they're taken to a vote counting area.
Yeah.
Through the mail, there's a truck, there's a person, there's a bag carrier, there's a processing facility, and then there's another delivery mechanism on the other side.
Yeah.
So when I just think about the number of hands or machines touching it, I actually think Dropboxes have some security benefits.
Yeah, I think the big.
Do you disagree with
I'm
that?
I'm putting myself into a conservative mindset. Mm-hmm. I think the real concern ultimately is just stuffing thousands of ballots into a box. And, I mean, and this is important. The 2,000 mules. I hear it over and over again.
Oh
2,000
my gosh!
Mules,
yes.
Dinesh and I were on campus together at the same time for a couple of years. So
Dinesh D'Souza.
Yeah. There is, and this is, it's been thoroughly debunked over and over again, not that people care who believe.
Hold that thought, because I got to go to break,
okay.
But it's an important thought, and I don't want to jump in. Ken Block is our special guest. That thought on 2,000 Mules and the fraudulency behind it when we come back, segment four, the take on 1 second.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a car. It's the two-door coupe that was there for your first drive. The hatchback that took you cross-country and back. And the minivan that tackles the weekly carpool. For the cars you couldn't live without, trust Amica Auto Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome back to The Takeout, our breakfast conversation. Any day now, our host restaurant, Ken Block, is our guest. Ken, you were talking about 2,000 Mules, which is a pseudo-documentary. It advertises itself as, and I can say that with confidence because recently, when the lawyers representing the producers of that film were asked, it was kind of a demand by Georgia investigators for the evidence underlying their assertions, they filed papers in court to say they have no evidence to back up their assertions. Those are not my words. Those are their words. Right. Ken Block, continue.
Yeah. This idea of lying and impugning elections as a potent political weapon, right?
And fundraising tool.
A rallying cry for your hardest core supporters, fundraising, as you say.
Cottage industry, basically.
There is a distinct problem of using it in that way, but then crossing over into the legal realm where there are consequences for lying. And, you know, we've watched Rudy Giuliani is maybe the most extreme case of his admitted lies about Ruby Freeman and what it's now cost him financially because
election
of the,
worker
the, because
in Fulton County, Georgia,
yeah, because
yeah.
of the defamation suit Moss. That yep. he lost. Carrie Lake is facing a defamation suit for her attacks on a election worker in Phoenix, and it, we're seeing with 2,000 Mules. Not that they're. This is more of, a, I think, an information gathering, legal gathering exercise, but it all has to be done under sworn testimony, and the lawyers involved can't lie about it, or they
right.
shouldn't lie about it.
Right.
And they didn't, and they said, we don't have any of the evidence
facing
to back it up.
Facing sanction, they admitted they had no evidence. Yeah.
And I guess that's the most remarkable thing about the narrative of voter fraud, mostly for me, is that real fraud, the fraud that is detectable, quantifiable, and verifiable, the
right.
stuff I work on,
right.
I could prove it wasn't there. The other claims of fraud, then the claims that weren't brought to my attention, right? The hearsay claims. I saw a mountain of ballots in a ditch. I saw a box truck full of ballots, right? The guy in Arizona who's talking about bamboo shoots in the paper,
yes,
right? I mean, you can
yes.
go on and on and
oh,
on
the bamboo
about the hearsay nature of this. And hearsay evidence is not legally acceptable evidence in any court of law in our country.
And the ninjas did it, and they didn't find it anyway.
Correct.
In Arizona. Just remember that, folks. I'm telling you, the story keeps changing, but the facts about the 2020 election don't. The data doesn't move. The hysterical, propagandistic, deceptive stories keep changing. That ball keeps moving, and it moves for a reason.
The goalposts move, and it's frustrating.
And you should be, I beg of you, think about that. Why does the story keep changing?
Because
it has to.
It has to. It has to.
I want to get to the back half of the book. I
Thank
promise you,
you
that.
Thank you.
How can we make elections, first of all, we should understand, ladies and gentlemen, I've talked about this before, are decentralized. It's one of the things that we love about our country. We decentralize things. We love local control, state management. It's in the Constitution, time, manner, and place. You wish there was a little more uniformity.
Yeah. So I want to tell you a couple of stories. You obviously know your stuff when it comes to elections. You probably know the answers, but I'm going to solicit them from you anyway. So let's imagine a scenario where I voted by mail early, 3 weeks before an election, and then unfortunately I was run over by a bus mm-hmm. before Election Day.
Yep.
So my ballot was mailed in. I died before Election Day. Does my vote count or does my vote not count?
It does count.
It depends on where you live.
But it depends on where you live.
Correct.
Right. Yes.
And sometimes it depends on which county you live in within
right.
a specific state. For now, when we talk about
it
election,
mostly counts is what
when,
I would
when
say.
You talk about election integrity,
right?
When I talk about it, I'm talking about this scenario where there's inconsistencies. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of conservatives talking about election integrity, which is just thinly disguised election denialism, and that's not what I'm talking about. And that's not what election integrity really is. How can it be that 15 states allow the votes? Roughly 15 states disallow those votes, and the other states don't have a law about it at all, right? Inconsistency is the enemy of integrity. And here, we have a very different experience for, granted, a dead voter, but it's a very different experience depending on where you live. Our election shouldn't be done that way. It should be the same experience across the board. I don't particularly care if it's thrown out or kept. In some ways, it's easier to keep it because it is very difficult and expensive to determine that someone is deceased.
Right.
So given that, I think we should really allow the votes to count. I have a grand compromise, if anybody from Congress is watching. I think that part of what we should be doing is we should also put a reasonable limit on the early voting windows, which is giving conservatives something, giving liberals something here. Count the votes, make the window 14 days.
Okay.
Which is a reasonable chunk of time
mm-hmm.
in
right.
which to cast your vote and package that and pass it and standardize this across the country. I have another quick one if it's
yeah,
okay.
Sure, please.
So I acquire voter data from as many states as will allow me to acquire it, and that's one of the things I do professionally. Many states, Florida, Pennsylvania, New York State, California, give you the data for free or for a nominal amount of money.
Right.
What would you guess is the state that charges the most, and how much do they charge?
I read the book. Alabama, $37,000.
Thank you for reading the book. There are not a lot of interviewers who get that far into it. I really appreciate you for that. Yes, $37,000 for Alabama's data. It's outrageous, and this happens because there is no standardization. federal standardization for what states should do for making this data available. And remember, every single state takes gobs of federal money to build their voting system. So it's legitimate for Congress to have some expectations about how things get run. By the way, you can't even get Massachusetts's voter roll. They have a state law that makes that data private. Even though the law says the Secretary of State can so choose to give it to somebody if they want to, I asked and I was told, well, we can't give it to you, but you can feel free to go to every single Massachusetts municipality, all 350 of them, to get the data.
Is voter ID a good remedy or solution or intervention?
I think it is, and the quiet secret is a lot of Democrats agree at this point that voter ID is a reasonable thing. In fact, H.R. 1, which was a failed election reform bill a couple of years ago, had voter ID baked into it as part of that.
A Democrat initiative embraced by the president.
Look, it's legitimate to want to make sure you know who's voting and that who's voting is eligible to vote. By the way, I think we should have a federal voter registration, not state-based voter registration, and every voter should be registered to vote automatically on birth or naturalization. Let's just take all the voter registration problems right off the table.
45 seconds. Are you nervous about the upcoming election?
I am. I don't like where the narratives are going right now. But I think President Trump has to be mindful that the election denialism is not a winning message.
It is a dead, cold loser.
For the general election. So it'll be interesting to see if he moderates his message about voter fraud. In fact, if he thinks he can win, how can he continue to impugn the election that hasn't happened yet? I think there's some real challenges there. Yeah, there's a lot of unsettled people out there right now. They're still spun up about 2020. I have great fears about what happens as a result of this election.
The voice of Ken Block, the book, one more time, Disproven, My Unbiased Search for Voter Fraud for the Trump Campaign, the data that shows why he lost and how we can improve our elections. Ken, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for your Takeout Outtake Especial. We'll see you next week. Welcome to your Takeout Outtake Especial. You know this is the fun and games part of the program. Ken Block is our special guest. Not every data analyst is a fun and games person by nature, but I'm sure, based on my interaction with Ken so far, we will have plenty of fun here in the Fun and Games segment. So, Ken, we have three questions we ask all of our guests. Take them in whichever order you prefer. Most influential book in your life and why? All-time favorite movie or one of your favorite movies? One way to think about that is if you're scrolling through anything and you see that movie, you always stop.
Yep.
And if you're on a long flight or a long drive and you're really going to enjoy some music, what artist or genre is that most likely to be?
Well, let's start with a movie.
Okay.
I was a usher in a movie theater back in the day.
Excellent.
And that was the summer of E.T.
Okay.
And I can tell you where in the movie the film is just based on the soundtrack. So
right. It's that embedded.
So it's that embedded. It is a huge part of my my adolescence. And so I'm just going to go with that one. Mm-hmm. That one's kind of a no-brainer. Boy, you know, from a book.
For me, one of the lovely parts of that movie is my middle name is Elliot.
Ah, nice.
Elliot. That's always a great part of that movie. So anyway, carry on, please.
All right. Boy, the book, that is an interesting. I'm an eclectic reader. I really read across a broad range of genres. I can honestly say, you know, I don't really go back and reread books. The handful that I did, but it's been years since I did it, you know, the Tom Clancy books were a draw for me. Again, back in the day. And
right.
I'd say, you know, in my recent adult life in the last 10 years or so, I'm not reading for pleasure much anymore. So,
but Tom Clancy is one of those authors in which you have a spy or a suspense narrative, but you also have a ton of facts and data and analytical research.
Yeah,
which strikes me as up your alley.
Yeah, it's guilty, right? Guilty. And
music.
Yeah, music. So. Again, fairly eclectic. I grew up playing the saxophone. I played in the jazz band in college. So I like jazz. Mm-hmm. I like big band. I grew up with classic rock. You know, so I'm mm-hmm. kind of a weird mix when it comes to all of that. And I love funk.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
It's give me a classic rock station. I'll listen to it. Give me some jazz, I'll listen to it. It really depends on the mood and whether I'm trying to stay awake or not.
So would Coltrane figure prominently in your heroes?
Love Coltrane. Love.
Not always easy to listen to, folks. I tell you this all the time. Coltrane's one of my favorite jazz performers, but you have to be in certain moods for certain aspects of Coltrane.
I had the great privilege.
It will sound to some ears harsh.
I had the great privilege of playing with Dizzy Gillespie.
You did?
Yes.
No way.
So yeah. It was great. Great.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where was that? Tell me that.
On campus. He came to campus and we played. The band played with him. Phenomenal. Phenomenal.
And did you get a chance to riff or improvisation? Did you just jump in and
roll? You know, depending on the song and what it was. Yeah, so it was.
And Dizzy would yield?
I can't say that we really talked all that much, honestly.
No, maybe like, but let others play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it was. It was great. We toured all over the world. It was great fun. So, yeah. That's a long answer for what I like to listen to. Here's a lobster bibs.
Oh, okay.
So we didn't get a chance to really wear these, but these are genuine Rhode Island lobster bibs. And I brought them just in case, because my wife's really nervous that, I was going to spill on myself.
Right, exactly.
So, but,
okay.
Here you go.
That is a first time on the takeout.
I was so worried somebody had done this.
In nearly 8 years, folks.
Perfect.
The Rhode Island lobster bib. You saw it here. We'll see you next week.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari, Jamie Benson, Sarah Cook, Ellie Watson, Jake Rosen, and Ashley Armstrong. CBSN production by Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, go to takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News.
If you like The Takeout, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.